the importance here is the role of the project leader is not to solve the problems. The role of the project leader is to provide the rigor and the control. If you think about the things that get somebody promoted to leader, they are the problem solver. They are the critical thinker, right? They can work in ambiguity. They just are the one that you go to. And typically that's what gets promoted. Those are not the skills you need to lead a lean culture, because in a lean culture, you need to empower and you need to guide, but like gently guide, so that you're not giving answers, but you're helping them get to the answers that they need to get to. And I used to tell people all the time, there's nothing to do with position and everything to do with passion.
Welcome to KPI Fireside. Our mission is simple: to improve companies and to improve careers through continuous improvement. In every episode, we explore the spark, the moment, the mindset, or the method that ignites real change. Whether you're just starting out or leveling up, you'll find the insights and inspiration to fuel your next improvement. Welcome back to KPI Fireside. I'm your host, Keith Norris. Our guest today is Christine Lavoie. Christine is a Lean Six Sigma Black Belt and Operational Excellence Leader with experience in supply chain, manufacturing, retail, and installation. She most enjoys project and training facilitation and people development, which she calls flipping the switch, to help grow a workforce of problem solvers and lean leaders. And Christina, are you in New England? Is that where you're at today?
I am. Yep. Live in New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. Awesome. Well, welcome to our podcast today. We're so happy to have you join us. Last time we connected was a number of years ago when you were with USLBM. And I think, didn't we have a workshop together up in Minnesota one day, if I remember right?
I think so, yeah. Or Wisconsin? Was it Wisconsin?
Wisconsin. Somewhere
up there. Yep. It's been a while. It's been a long time.
Awesome. So yeah, we're so happy to have you join us here. Tell us a little bit about what you're up to and where you're at now.
I work for Safelite Auto Glass. You're probably going to be singing the song now the rest of the day in your head, but
jingles in my head already.
Yeah, exactly. And I do very similar work to what I did at USLBM. So as a black belt, just really going around helping the local teams solve local problems, but then also company-wide helping some large-scale business processes improve, as well as look into the future and how can we prepare for the future.
So I know a lot of people, when they hear black belt, they think karate and martial arts and, you know, beating up on bad guys or whatever. It's not that kind of black belt, right?
Right. I can always tell somebody's reaction when I say, I'm a black belt and Lean Six Sigma. Like, oh, that's so cool. I'm like, no, you got the wrong idea. It is not that black belt, but it really is just this belting certification. You can go yellow, green, and black. And it really just comes down to what level are you at with the job? And so if you're a full-time professional, you're probably going to want to be a black belt.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, we like to start this podcast with a little segment we call the spark. And the spark is like this idea when you first got, you used the term flip the switch, but I'm curious in your career, like maybe where you started, but at what point did you feel like you wanted to make this continuous improvement thing your career path? Do you remember that moment?
I definitely do. So my career, I have a degree in criminal justice. And so sometimes people might say, I don't even get, how does that connect? But to me, it's just that sort of investigative mind, right? You just sort of are curious and you want to figure out why things work, why things don't work. So that's where I started. And I was working in loss prevention. I was working in asset protection. And that moved into some leadership roles where I had direct reports. So I just sort of was taking opportunities wherever I could and learning, love to learn. And then I decided to sort of put it aside. I had an opportunity to take a severance package. And I thought, I want to just go in a different direction. And I took the severance package and said, okay, well, what am I doing now? And I got a job with a company, Wallboard Supply, and they were a division of USLBM.
Okay. Construction materials, basically, right?
Yeah, drywall, exactly. Yeah, yes. Which, and our customer were the general contractor, so we would deliver to job sites. So in my interview process, the initial job was supposed to be some sort of executive assistant. But in the interview process, the president said, you know, you have a lot of background and experience in different things that I think you can help this company. with, so we're going to hire you on, but we don't know what your title is yet. And they came up with a title. I think I was 3 or 4 weeks into the job already. And they came up with the title of, we're going to call you the process improvement specialist. We're going to send you to yellow belt.
Okay.
And I said, all right, I have no idea what they're talking about, but I said, I'll do it. And so I went to yellow belt, UW, go Badgers. I got to do
Wisconsin,
this for
right?
Scott.
Yeah.
So I went there and I got my yellow belt. And that was absolutely the first time I realized there was methodology to how I felt like I thought anyway. You know, I definitely didn't have the methodology behind it, but I had the mindset. And so this just all clicked for me that, wow, there are actually a system that you can follow to get to that end result that you're always looking to get at. And that was it. That was it. And then I was all in.
You were all in.
Yeah.
You know, some folks listening to this are experienced, you know, Lean Six Sigma black belts like yourself. And some folks are just, you know, kind of, I don't know, casually interested in this topic, I suppose. What is a yellow belt training? What is it that they teach you in that yellow belt training?
The yellow belt is going to teach you basically everything you need to know to run a project. So, you know, there's the Kaizen project, which is really focused on maybe one work group, small process stream. It's not a large scale problem. You don't probably know the solution yet, but you can get to it pretty quickly. So 3 to 5 days. This is the length of that project, and you still put a group together. DMAIC is the larger. It stands for Define, Measure, Analyze, Improve, Control. And you also learn the DMAIC methodology in yellow belt. You spend most of your time in that, in the yellow belt, mainly because, as the instructor said, if I teach you how to make the Christmas dinner, anytime you have to go make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, it's a breeze. And so DMAIC is the Christmas dinner. Yeah.
I love that story.
It's great, yeah. And so a DMAIC, for those that may not know, it's a larger scale, more complex problem. You don't know the solution. You actually don't even know the cause. I can give you a quick analogy. Think of a dartboard, right? So the bullseye is your problem and your dart is the solution. If it's a just do it, a very obvious problem, a very obvious solution, you just throw the dart, you're going to hit it.
Go do it.
A Kaizen event, you're stepped back a little bit and you might hit it, you might not. And so just to make sure you're going to solve the right problem, you do a little work ahead of time. You want to understand it a little better. A DMAIC is like you're out of the room, around the corner, you can't even see the dartboard. So you don't want to throw any darts. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that's the analogy that I was always given.
I'm kind of picturing, like, I played golf recently. I'm not a huge golfer. I know a lot of people can relate to golf. There's these, like, some long par fives that have a dog leg right or left leg, right off the tee. You can't even see where the pin is at. You know, you like got to go one way and then go another way. I like that analogy, how you described the DMAIC project. Like, if you can't even see the dartboard, you're not even quite sure what the problem really is.
Yeah. Don't throw the dart.
that's a good one. So all of this is around process improvement and, you know, a lot of terms get used. I hear business improvement. You know, some folks use like the yellow belt, green belt, black belt type analogies. One thing that I always thought was really interesting about USLBM and the way that you guys were structured there was that relationship with the University of Wisconsin. Talk about that, because we kind of just ran past that, but I think that was an interesting little tie-in that you guys
Yeah, I've actually not seen this in a lot of other places. And I know that UW would talk about USLBM in their other courses to their public classes. So UW actually created a yellow belt, green belt for USLBM. Now it's the certification is the certification. So they had to meet certain requirements. But by having this relationship and us filling classes, we were able to cater or tailor some of the information to our business specifically, which was great for our people. So we had this relationship. We were creating this culture in our business of empowering people and educating people, giving them the tools that they needed to solve problems. And then as a result, like I said, UW really tailored it to us so that our teams, I mean, because we're talking to everybody went. So from, you know, CEO to field. So we wanted everybody to be able to absorb this information and use it.
I think this is such an interesting thing. And I hadn't really planned on talking about this, but I mentioned this golf thing. I went to a golf tournament last week. And one of the people that I met was the president of the university. And we ended up getting talking about various things. But one thing I know about the state of affairs right now, a lot of things in the world are changing. One thing that is facing their own burning platform, to use kind of a lean analogy, is education, right? A lot of educational institutes, costs keep rising. The value of degrees is like changing. But I think that's an interesting way that somebody inside USLBM got together with somebody at the university and said, hey, we're not going to pay for a four-year degree for all of our employees to go through, but maybe you could put something together that would be useful for us. And there are multiple courses that the university offered that USLBM was sending people to? Or was it just like one course that everybody went through?
For the most part, it was the belting certifications. Now, once you got to black belt, there was sort of this library of classes that you could choose in order to meet your black belt requirement. But we know that's a big time commitment. And so we also knew it's almost like a funnel, right? We looked at it as a funnel. Everybody's white belt. White belt's going to give us the introduction. And at least everybody speaks the same language and everybody understands what our culture is. Less people are going to go to yellow belt. And usually it is that when they flip that switch and they say, oh my gosh, I love white belt. I love what it means. I want to learn more. Those people will go to yellow belt. Now, I will say we had a pretty good expectation around what they did with it. So I think that's an important part of having this sort of program is, yes, we're going to send you and we're going to invest in you, but what are you going to do with that knowledge? And so we had requirements on projects. You know, yellow belts, they would run a project. Green belt, they would run a DMAIC project, and they would have a sponsor, and they would have a big presentation at the end and a graduation. So so I think it's important to have those expectations. But yes, we're developing them. And also, it's a great retention tool.
Yeah.
You know?
I love it. I think it's great. I mean, one thing I love about this discipline of continuous improvement is how Stephen Covey might use the term win-win, like, you know, you're teaching employees these skills that are not just how to do one job in one company, but this problem-solving process that, you know, you've transitioned to a different company. I am assuming that you didn't have to stay in the wallboard space.
No.
You know, like you can transition. And the more you understand different kinds of problems, you realize like the sequence that you can go through is so similar.
Yeah. Absolutely.
How much time, the white belt, the very first level, was that something that was part of like an employee onboarding, like every employee learned that? How much time did that take an employee as part of their onboarding? A couple hours?
Well, actually, we kind of had them separate. We had onboarding, which was just a segment of continuous improvement within their onboarding materials. But then white belt was a four-hour course that we taught. Okay. We developed it and we taught it ourselves.
I see. Okay.
Yep. And so that was on site. We would go to them and we tried to get to everybody. So.
And that's what you did in that. I don't know if your title was like director of continuous improvement or something, but you were kind of representing the improvement office and facilitating improvements. How many sites did you guys support there in that role at USLBM, like different locations?
Yeah. I mean, at the time, and it was growing. I think at the time it was 400 plus, and then it just kept growing over to 500. So yeah, I mean, we were national. So we traveled all, there were only three of us that did the job. So it's a little bit of a funny story, very quick, but they had created, so we had Greenbelt class. I was working for Wallboard. I went to Greenbelt because I was the process improvement specialist. And at this point, they opened up this job. Well, I had actually had to have surgery that year, and I was out on medical, and I saw the job posting, and I applied for it. It was pretty rigorous, considering it was an internal interview. Five separate interviews, but they created these three positions, and they hired nationally, and it turned out that the three people hired, we were all in that same Greenbelt class. But I did have a friend say to me, did you just get a promotion when you were out on medical leave? And I was like, I think I did. So it was a brand new position, which was amazing for me because we really got to have some fun in going next level with it. What is this going to look like? How do we build this out?
I love that you had a promotion opportunity with this, because that's one of the things, again, I love about this discipline is I think it's such a good track to career advancement. Like, you're going to learn this skill set. And if you're someone who's interested in being engaged in your work and just problem solving, somebody who wants to just not go to work and punch a clock and live for the weekends, but actually enjoy what you're doing, there's so many layers of just interesting problem solving to do in this type of work. So it's great that your story includes like the promotion that came from diving into that. That's
right.
That's awesome.
And actually, I can go one better, Keith, and tell you that of the three of us, one was a CDL driver. He worked in Wisconsin, and he just had this passion. And I used to tell people all the time, this has nothing to do with position and everything to do with passion. So it doesn't matter what your role is. If you're passionate and you want to learn and exercise this, you're going to go places. And so sure enough, you know, he just, it was recognized by everyone that he had this passion for it and he was doing great things with it. And so he got chosen too. So this was a big promotion for him as well. So
I love it. And I think it's interesting that you have a criminal justice degree as a background. I actually saw an article a couple of days ago that was, this one was not, I think it was like the 10 most underemployed college degrees that you can have, and criminal justice was like in the top few. But I think it's interesting because you said the part of like what drew you to criminal justice was probably like the mystery and the solving and, you know,
exactly
kind of that
right.
part of it.
Yeah.
I've also talked to folks in this lean discipline who are actually a little bit, I remember Tyson Heaton, we've got a great episode with Tyson from Lean Enterprise Institute. And he said his advice was like, get curious, be curious. But he kind of leveled with us and said, look, my default reaction isn't always curiosity. Sometimes it's annoyance and frustrated and, you know, I'm mad. So I think that there's also an element of, if you're an unreasonable person and you just don't like the way things are, or the way things are operating, or when things are just not functioning how they should, that's kind of like another little leverage point of, hey, maybe this discipline has got something for you because this is a set of tools to make change when it's obvious to you, but it's not obvious to everybody else.
Yeah. I mean, that's such a great point. I think you see two different groups, really. There's the one group that's frustrated by a broken process that says, well, management won't even do this, or management needs to come do this. And then you have the other one that maybe doesn't realize they're empowered to do it, or maybe hasn't been empowered yet to do it. And this is what I love about when you really do adopt a continuous improvement culture, you are empowering your people to say, if this bugs you, let's fix it. Let's get together and fix it. And so, you know, I joke about flipping the switch, but some people just need that. They need to know, I'm empowered? Okay, I'll run with it.
Explain, you use that term a couple of times, flip the switch. What does that look like? How do you go about doing that? How do you find the switch in a dark room?
I mean, I start all the time teaching white belt. And if I had a room of 30 people, if it happened to two, I was psyched, you know? And what would it would look like basically is as you start to talk about process. And the thing I love about continuous improvement too, is it's very much process driven, not people. And when you're used to working in chaos, inadvertently, we tend to point fingers and we think it's a performance issue and not a process issue. And so here we are teaching everybody, no, we think it's a process issue. So let's look at the process before we look at performance. You don't know how well you can function with your current resources until you're optimized. And so once people start hearing that, you do see people say, oh, wow, hold on a second. And they start thinking. And at the end of the 4-hour class, we would brainstorm. So we'd break into groups. We'd have the big easel, you know, post-it notes on the wall, and they would write down their brainstorming ideas of what would be a good project right now in your current state that you would love to work on. And you've got, you know, different work groups working together on this brainstorm session. So they're hitting every part of the business. And that's when you would really start to see that passion ignited. And then after that, I'd get pictures from somebody. And I mean, this would be as simple as like the cab of my truck. Like what I did to the cab of my truck, I organized it, you know. So that's what I mean by that. And, you know, if it was 10% of the people, that was great. But that was enough to move the culture forward.
That's so interesting. So I want to drill into more of the stuff at USLBM and the work that you did, but I also want to shed some light on what are you doing now? You're at SafeLight. What is the actual role and what are you doing there at SafeLight now?
Yeah, it's actually very similar. You know, black belt on a process improvement team. There's five of us on the team. And so we are somewhat doing project work separately, you know, just sort of divide and conquer in some significant areas. And then we also are part of larger groups that are more business focused, maybe some business process problems or business goals that we want to help work on, but we bring the methodology to this. So there's a little bit of a systematic approach to understanding how we get from A to B.
I'm curious, how are you guys, organized like geographically or across business lines? I understand SafeLight. I could probably sing the jingle, SafeLight Repair, SafeLight Replace, whatever. But I tend to think, I had my windshield replaced a little while ago, and I actually think the place I went ended up 2 years later being part of SafeLight. So I'm guessing that it's probably a large company. I don't know if there's sub brands. Is it all one brand or there are separate brands?
It's all one brand. It's actually probably a similar business model to USLBM, which is acquisitions.
Okay.
M&A. There's M&A here as well. So that's probably what happened. We acquired it. So one brand, SafeLight, and we are part of a global company, Belron.
Okay.
But SafeLight is the U.S. Segment of this larger global company. And here, it's a similar setup. We're not regional. So even though I'm in New England, I don't cover New England, although it does make sense that if they need some quick support, I'm here. So we do that, but we travel wherever we're needed to go. And I think we've got 800 locations in the ballpark. Yeah.
I'm not trying to disclose any secrets here, but
yeah.
Just for anybody listening to want to get a sense, are they talking about a small company like mine or a big company like mine or whatever? USLBM was built through acquisitions. It was a lot of small building, separate building materials. If I remember it, doors over here and windows over there and trusses over here, and USLBM kind of rolled it all up. And your tenure with them was, I'm guessing they grew a lot probably while you were there.
An enormous amount. Yeah. That was probably their biggest growth period while I was there. Yeah.
I seem to recall through Scott G. I love Scott. Actually, I think Scott
love him.
Might have connected us recently because I was reaching out to him. So hi, Scott. Hopefully you get a chance to listen to this.
Hi, Scott.
But I've always been super impressed with Scott's mind around continuous improvement. I think he was a big part of just that senior executive driving the vision of what continuous improvement needed to be, because it's one of those things that, again, it feels like it's natural. It feels like it's the job that every manager and every leader and every organization should always do, but it's not something that happens naturally.
Mm-mm.
Maybe you could talk about the perspective of this continuous improvement function, a job that somebody needs to be assigned to do, or is it something that just everybody, can figure out?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I do want to just acknowledge the fact that I had the unbelievable good fortune of working under Scott. So that was when they created these roles, they put Scott G in charge of it, Scott Gertie Jensen. And that was just unbelievable good luck for me, because he is just an incredible boss, incredible leader, and just a great guy and hilarious, really funny. So, but to answer your question, I would say, and if I'm understanding your question right, it's not natural. And I'll go into the second part too about how that should look, but it's not natural because of a couple of reasons, I think. One, especially for leadership, if you think about the things that get somebody promoted to leader, they are the problem solver. They are the critical thinker, right? They can work in ambiguity. They just are the one that you go to. And typically that's what gets promoted. Those are not the skills you need to lead a lean culture, because in a lean culture, you need to empower and you need to guide, but gently guide, so that you're not giving answers, but you're helping them get to the answers that they need to get to. And you're helping them become problem solvers. So it's a little less hands-off, although it can't be completely hands-off. And so I think to answer your question about, do you assign it? I personally feel like if we're talking culture, continuous improvement culture, that has got to be everybody caring about it in the same way safety works that way, right? So if only a few people care about it, even if it's a leader, you're never going to go anywhere with it. That said, you still need that top-down support. So the other thing that I see that I think fails sometimes is, and this is probably well-intentioned, hey, I'm a leader, I'm going to empower you, and then I support you, but that support is actually incredibly passive. So support sometimes means I'm just not going to get in your way, but I'm not going to talk about it, I'm not going to encourage it, I'm not even going to really think about it, I'm going to come to you and I'm going to talk about your KPIs, or I'm going to talk about, the other things that we're really driving as a company. So if I, as a leader, even if I assign it to you, I don't ever really support it actively, it's going to fail. So I kind of think bottom applied, top down driven.
is with Safelite or with USLBM, given that you do acquisitions, I know that there's a business out there for private equity firms to go in and find companies in industries where they know the industry really well, but maybe the business hasn't been operating as well as it could. And they come in and they apply these practices like lean, continuous improvement, and, you know, improve the business and whatnot. We haven't talked about this. I'm just guessing maybe Safelite or USLBM did an acquisition of a company that didn't have this culture. And part of your role was to like, hey guys, this is what we're going to do now. Is there ever been a time where that isn't well received? Or maybe you have some lessons on how to do it so that you can get that welcome greeting rather than resistance? How do you do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I have seen that. I have seen some real resistance and pushback. And to me, what we did was those first few months after an acquisition, it's drinking from the fire hose. I mean, that new acquisition is just completely engulfed in corporate. Okay, this is your new company. This is the new culture. Here's what HR is. Here are all the new systems that you have to, you know, I mean, it's just a fire hose. And so from a continuous improvement standpoint, we know it's important to get in early, but not so early that they're going to say, look, that's too much. So we always waited a good 3 to 4 months at least. And then it was just sort of a soft connect. Hey, how are you? Listen, I know you have a lot going on. I just wanted to introduce myself. I'm going to be a good business partner for you. And here's what I can help you accomplish. And to me, that's the sell with continuous improvement. I am not here for me. I'm not here to meet metrics for me. I'm here for you to help you make your job easier, more efficient, and safer.
This episode is brought to you by KPI Fire, the all-in-one platform for continuous improvement. With KPI Fire, you can align strategy, drive execution, and engage your people. So whether you're leading a team or driving enterprise-wide change, KPI Fire helps you deliver real results. Learn more at www.kpifire.com.
And so that was always the approach, because when all these things are coming at them, here's somebody with a little bit of a lifeline to say, I'm going to help you through this. And so that was one way we had approached it. And then another area where we would sometimes see a little resistance is if you acquire a company, or a company maybe that has multiple locations, sometimes they'll have their own internal system of continuous improvement. And then you have to say, oh, let's take a look at it. Okay, well, we do it this way. And so that's almost sometimes harder. When people have, I'm familiar with it and I do continuous improvement, but it's completely different. And now you're trying to get me to change it. So I've seen both, but I think give them a little time and be the lifeline.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Are there some like specific questions that you might ask to these leaders to help create that, I guess, receptivity? Like, is it just something open-ended, like, how can I help you? Or is it, you know, do you have more of a directional approach to that? Do you have like a list of questions that you would use or anything along those lines?
Yeah, never really anything formal in that way, because one of the things that I think is so critical with continuous improvement is understanding the flexibility of it and your audience. And so how you are able to, I don't want to say change your message, because the message is pretty much all encompassing. It's beneficial for all, but how you can maybe tailor it to the audience that you have, depending on their role, depending on their needs, their specific challenges. So in this acquisition-based business model, you're going to see, you know, unique challenges in different areas. I could be manufacturing, I could be making stair trusses, but then I'm over here delivering drywall. Well, we've got completely different challenges. So understanding your audience and putting some thought into how you want to approach them based on that. But I've always found the easiest way to start off with somebody is to just ask them, what's frustrating you? You know, what's getting in the way? Yeah, that's like the easiest way.
That's such a great question. What's frustrating you?
What's frustrating you? What's getting in your way? Because everybody wants to talk about that. And everybody knows right off the top of their head what that is. And so it just lends itself to an immediate conversation.
I love that. That's a brilliant one. What's frustrating you? That's like a great open door.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, right. And it's open-ended, and it's not a yes or no. It's not, you know, so it's a good conversation starter, I think.
You know, I know some organizations, you know, through their evolution, I think that just like anything in this world related to us humans, there's like this life cycle approach to it, probably goes through different states of accelerated growth and maturation and decline or whatnot. But I know that some folks will send people to a green belt training and then expect them to like just run all these projects and do all this stuff. And you've said something that I think kind of gives me the idea that you've got a different perspective on where you want to evolve to. I mean, somebody like yourself, you said probably your first exposure to this was go and do a project and, you know, have some sort of an impact. But now in this like facilitator role, how has your role shifted from doing projects to helping facilitate projects?
I mean, that's another great question, because we do see, you know, the challenges for us was that any kind of project leader was also going to be what we call a role-based project leader, meaning I have another job that I do.
So it's a part-time thing that they're doing on top of their regular job.
Yes, yes. And, you know, when you start getting into a little bit of a more complex problem, like a DMAIC style problem, you're talking some time commitments there. And so switching into facilitation for me, you know, and a project leader too, I want to just mention this. The importance here is the role of the project leader is not to solve the problems. The role of the project leader is to provide the rigor and the control to the process of solving the problem, especially when you have a team of people that have other jobs and are very busy. And so this project leader has got to be very organized, somebody that has good influence, good skills on keeping everybody on task, time management, that kind of stuff. That's kind of what you look for in a project manager, a project leader. The facilitator is similar in that you are trying to keep everybody going in the right direction. You know, you want to me, it's more about helping them connect the dots as a facilitator and take what they've learned either in the classroom or just, you know, in an onboarding or anything and applying it in real world. So one thing for us that was really important was any kind of real world examples or even some exercises that we did for hands-on. We tried to make it very relevant to the business, because otherwise, you know, people are going to say, yeah, that doesn't mean anything to me. We don't do that kind of business, you know? So if we're not manufacturing, you take me through a tack time exercise, that doesn't mean anything to me. I don't produce anything, right? So we always try to tailor that to who we were dealing with too. But I think, you know, the project leader, it's a little bit different than a team member, what you're trying to get out of them.
Yeah.
So
I think it's interesting. So you're kind of using some specific language and terms, and I want to drill into this a little bit because I think there's some interesting stuff here. So again, like in the scenario where you're onboarding maybe a newly acquired company, I'm guessing that you probably have to teach them like the language of USLBM or the language of Safelite. What are some of those, like, I don't know if you actually have like a vocabulary document, but like you've used terms like white belt or yellow belt or project leader, project sponsor. What are some of the terms that might be part of, like, you know, improvement 101, like this is the language that you need to learn. These are what some of the terms mean.
Yeah. Oh boy. Okay. This is like, I have to rattle them off of my off the top of my head. Gosh, I mean, DMAIC is definitely a big one, you know, root cause. Yeah. And some of them are kind of self-explanatory. You can kind of get what that means, but they're very common terms. Tack time just refers to the pace of a throughput. So, you know, if we're producing something, what is the pace of the throughput? How many a minute can we produce? How many an hour can we produce? And how do we make sure that we keep that pace where we need it to be for production levels? So, you know, things like that.
What are some of like the roles involved with the project? Because you were having a good riff there on like the leader versus the team member. What are the other roles of a project that somebody, you know, deal with?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest, most important roles is the sponsor. So you have your project leader, and again, they're the rigor and the control around the project. The team member is the contributor, and they are often, well, I think there's two great team members. So there's a team member that is familiar with the process because they're going to give you the insight to the process. And so when you start to brainstorm, what if we did this? They're going to say, well, this is why this would work, or this is why this wouldn't work. That's a double-edged sword. In addition to that, you need the person who has no idea with, you know, no familiarity with this process.
Yeah.
And because they're going to ask all the great questions. Well, why do you do that? So they're the ones that have no stake in the game and are not set in their ways, and they're going to ask questions. So those are two important team members. The sponsor is the person who we used to call it the checkbook. I mean, that's one role, right? They're the decision maker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that the person that gets to say, hey, it's okay for you guys to work on this project, go spend 10 hours a week or 40 hours a week or whatever, yes. 2 hours a week?
Yes. And the sponsor is going to be the person that will escalate upstream if you're having any roadblocks or any issues or challenges. So they're going to represent the project upstream all the way up to the executive team. And they're also going to remove roadblocks when you need it. So they're sort of that first step escalation. And again, they're that decision maker to say, you have this budget, you don't have this budget. That is not the problem we want to solve. You know, this is a goal that we're, you know, just keeping us aligned with objectives and goals. Yeah. But basically they're a touch point. You know, you update them during milestones, you update them, you know, like I said, if there's an escalation issue or if you're changing gears and going into a different direction, that kind of thing. The last thing I was going to mention, the last thing is the subject matter expert. We call him SMEs.
Yes, the SME, the SME.
The SME, yeah. And yeah. So that person's critical too. And they're just a consultant. So they don't really need to spend as much time on the project as the rest of the team, but you do need to loop them in every now and then because they are that subject matter expert.
Love it. This, I know I'm going way off script, but this is taking me just, I'm just curious on this. If we were to look at your calendar and look at like reoccurring appointments that you do that have to do with your role, I'm curious, what are some of the rituals or repeating appointments that you have related to this role and facilitating this inside of your organization?
Are they? Yes. So I have recurring meetings with my boss, and that's just that touch point. Keep him up to date with what we're doing. Recurring meetings with the team, the project team that I have. I actually have a couple of teams. I have a recurring thing on my calendar is focus time that I block off for myself.
That's a great one. Highly recommend it for everybody.
Right? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Whenever somebody else has access to your calendar, you got to put that focus time on there to protect your brain, yeah. Your energy.
And we're so much in that world now because, you know, I have so many emails and calls that you just tell people, like, just jump into my calendar. It's up to date and add a call if you need to. And so, yeah, to block off that time is important for me. It's mostly updating and it's mostly facilitating. So I'll give you an example. So we have this project team right now and we're moving in from solutions to implementation. So we've already gone through all of the DMAIC part of it. It's a DMAIC project. We've come up with our solutions. And now we're working on the implementation of it. And so what does that mean? What do we need to procure? What kind of documents do we need to develop to support the implementation of this so that people feel like they are given what they need to run with it? How do we manage the change? Is there any sort of strategic change management plan we need to put together? So that's where we're at right now. And that's a lot of meetings.
With this word project that we use, I mean, projects are everywhere. I think everybody has some scope of reference for what a project is. But I also know that's one of those things that differs wildly across organizations in terms of how long they are, how big they are. For you guys, and maybe if I need some examples from USLBM or SafeLight, what do you guys determine that's a project or that's many projects versus that's not really a project, that's just, I don't know, like, not even a just do it, just like,
yeah.
Do you have any rules of thumb that you use for how to size up the amount of work that a particular improvement is?
That's a good question. And, you know, for me, I've always sort of kept it in mind of how many work groups is this hitting? So if it's hitting one work group, that's a quickie. That's probably a Kaizen event. If you're hitting multiple work groups, let's take a little more time to collect some data and understand what we're dealing with. Who is this, you know, this issue within the process? Who is it hitting? You know, how often is it hitting? Where in the process is it hitting? And so I guess it kind of starts there for me. The other thing is I think it's important to, you know, when you create this culture of continuous improvement, you do have people that want to solve, which is a great thing. However, you run the risk of having people solving all kinds of things all at the same time. Some of them overlap and they don't know it. And so there's this siloed work that can happen because everybody's all ready. Like, I know what needs to be done and I'm ready to go. And so that's the thing too. That's sort of the caution there of once you've empowered people to solve, you have some sort of organization around how do we choose? How do we prioritize? And I think that starts with your company's goals. What are your goals this year? And so then you start to look at, okay, let's make a tree coming down from here. Where are we putting some of these opportunities? Some people do value streaming, right? Value stream map. Here's how we can take a look at our company's whole value stream and find where we have these opportunities all along it, from customer to installation or production. And that's another way of prioritizing it. So I think there's got to be some prioritization. There's got to be some shared goals. You know, everybody's aligned. And then there has to be good communication. This is where I would probably tap into your black belts to say, if we have these larger scale projects, let's make sure we're taking in one of the black belts or the Lean Six Sigma professionals to help us make sure we are doing this efficiently. Because you want the process to be efficient, but you want the problem solving to be too.
In terms of goals, this is an area that's infinitely interesting to me. You mentioned goals. Again, I don't want to ask you for anything confidential with your companies, but I'm assuming that there's like some common goals that you've seen at the strategic level. I find that goals is this kind of interesting thing that people exist on this continuum of like their understanding of goals. Like some people will look at goals as like, we want to reduce the number of customer complaints from 10 to 6. And you know, everything they've been taught about SMART goals is like, it's very micro. Whereas when you do that, you kind of like lose the big picture of like, we want happy customers generally. Like from a continuous improvement, like goals can almost like cut somebody's legs out versus inspire them. What are some examples of like strategic goals or strategic portfolios that you've seen leaders hand down that have been really like motivating and inspiring for the troops, you might say, in continuous improvement, to give them a North Star to like really drive towards? Are there some examples that you've seen used?
Yeah. I think, you know, typically I feel like it starts with a lagging indicator, like what you were saying, happy customers, you know. And so I think when you share that information, especially if it's more the reactive one, hey, everybody, this is what we want to do as a company. This is why. And this is what's going to result for us, what we're going to get out of this if we achieve this goal. So it's just that communication and that understanding. I think that communication is so huge. I've just seen it. I've seen both. I've seen people have the information and not have the information. And they don't need all of it, right? But whatever they are able to take in at the level that they're at is huge in adopting the, hey, I'm all in. I'm here for this, you know? But then I think you also have to take those lagging indicators, like the customer sat, and break that down into a tangible leading metric. Okay, we know we want to improve customer sat, but if I just come at you with this great big, you know, ambiguous goal, I'm checked out because I've been here for a long time and I know we've already tried this and I know we haven't gotten anywhere, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think if we're able to take those little lagging goals and say, here's how, this is what we do. If we do A, B, and C, we can see the impact all the way to the end goal with what we have. So I think breaking it down into something that makes sense for people, especially in the front line, and also that, you know, the importance of it. This is why we're doing this. This is what we're all going to get out of this if we do it. And that's probably a simple answer, but.
Yeah, that's great. Like explaining the why behind the goal is important. I think that's something that a lot of leaders neglect to do, particularly like the hard driving know-it-all, like I've got all the answers type leader. They're just like, look, I know exactly what we need to do when you do this. Here's the goal.
Yeah.
So let me ask you the question this way. If there's a leader like that is out there listening to this and they're thinking, how can I better work with my CI team, you know, what advice might you give a leader like that in how to leverage the CI team or how to empower the CI team?
I love this question, Keith. And I do have an answer. I think if you allow the CI team, or at least representatives of them, so if you have top leaders in the CI team, allow them to be in the room for all of those conversations. They're a business partner, right? So when we start to strategically talk about what we want to accomplish at the high level, somebody with the CI experience and understanding and knowledge is in that room. And so I will say this with USLBM, we had a representative in just about every conversation. So we had a representative on the ELT, we had representatives below the ELT. And so every level, when RVPs were having their meeting with their teams, one of us was there, at least to incorporate it. And so now just by being part of the conversation, you're able to say, here's how I think we can do it. Here's how I think we can break this down for people. Here's how I think we can approach it. So just be in the room. Just let them be a business partner.
ELT, executive leadership team?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and I love the theme of respect, which is a pillar of foundation in this idea of lean, and the respect of inviting the right people into the conversation. I think that that's one of those lessons about process improvement work that I personally have learned is, what's the saying? It's like, slow down to go faster. Sometimes as a hard driving leader, you think that giving the answers or commanding the direction is the fastest way to get there. But in fact, it's not.
Right, right.
What kind of things would you say to someone who is like, this improvement thing is now on the table, and somebody feels like, what? So I have this full-time job and now you want me to do this other thing? Like,
yeah. Yeah. Common, very, very common. And I don't know that you can eradicate that like immediately, but I think what we've always tried to tell people, and by the way, that's just fatigue, right? That's not necessarily a continuous improvement issue. It's just you're coming at me with things and they stick, they don't stick, and there's seven different iterations and I'm fatigued. So here's another thing, and that's how it's seen. So I think that's something to be aware of even before you get to the CI piece of it. Roll out something well, let it stick, ensure it sticks, and then move on to the next thing. But if you start rapid fire things at your people and just, you know, that whole fail fast thing, which there's a time and a place. So I just want to emphasize, there's a time and a place for some of those action-based problem-solving things. But it can't be everything that way. And so I think with continuous improvement, have a really good rollout. You know, and then we used to try to explain, and this is going to be this is a simple approach to this, but, and it's going to be more complex in real life, but we used to explain to people that this is not something you have to do in addition to what you do. This is how you what you do. So we're just trying to remove roadblocks in this mindset. We're not trying to add to what you do. You know, so again, it's not like everybody was like, oh, I got it. You're great. So, you know, we had to work through some of that as well. But, you know, I think it just, you know, it starts with not exhausting your people with change in that rapid fire way. And then it ends with the sustainability. So people are getting used to a culture of change, which is typically what they resist, especially if things don't stick. I've heard the expression, a culture where they can decline. So I don't think I'm going to opt in.
Culture, an optional decline culture.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah. If I wait it out, it'll go away.
We'll wait the boss out on this one.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay. So in the position as the facilitator of CI, director of CI type role, let's say there's some people out there that are listening to this that are managers or supervisors of teams. It's not their 100% job. They know that as a manager and as a leader, like, they want to do a good job. They know that employee engagement matters. They know that they need to be continuously improving. What are some things that you know that you would want to say to somebody who's a typical manager and supervisor about this discipline that you're an expert in that they might be able to start, you know, using tomorrow and in their typical work? What are some lessons that you might have for them?
Yeah, I think number one, Keith, is Gemba. Get out on the floor, go talk to your people, listen. You know, I think there's only one thing worse than not getting their ideas and their feedback. It's taking them and not using them. So be cautious. Like, if you're going to actually go out and start to talk to people and say, what's getting in your way? What can we do? Then you really should have a system of following through with that, whether it's an idea funnel, recognition on the board, hey, we got this idea and this is what we did with it, you know. But I'd say number one is just go out and talk to people, you know. And I know that can be hard, but there's self-awareness there. If I could tell really quickly this story, I had a store manager one time say to me, I just can't get anything done during the day and I don't know why. Can somebody come sit with me and just figure out what's happening, why I can't get anything done? I said, absolutely. And so I spent the whole day with him and I just watched all day long somebody knock on the door. Hey, this customer called and they're wondering, blah, blah, blah. Okay, I'll call them back. Hey, we have an issue in the warehouse. Okay, I'll be right there. And the mess, and I let this all, I just took it all in. I was taking notes. And at the end of the day, we sat, I said, when somebody makes you aware of a problem, you don't have to take it and put it on your plate. Help them solve it. All you have to do literally is just say, what would you do? And that's your question back. What do you think we should do? And the more you start asking that, the more they are prepared when they come to you, because they know they're going to. You're going to ask it. So that's such a simple thing. Like, hey, there's a customer that's unhappy. Okay, what do you think we should do? And they know the answer. And so that's how you empower them. That's how you take it off of your plate. It's how you engage them. I think that's number one.
I love that. You've shared some really great questions with us today. What frustrates you? What do you think we should do as a response to a question? I love what you said about be careful what you ask for. You just might get it. Like, hey, what frustrates you? What ideas do you have? How does that leader, what should they do with those ideas that are shared with them? Particularly, like, let's say there's one that they're just not interested in taking on or dealing with. What do they do in that situation?
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's going to be the case. And I think transparency is key. You have to be open and honest and say to your team, hey, even if you're going to implement this now, hey, we're going to do this idea funnel, or we're going to do this system where we collect ideas. We won't be able to do all of them. We are going to prioritize them. And maybe you even tell them how. We're going to prioritize them based on ABC. But the transparency is key. And then also just showing them, these are the ones we chose, and here's why we chose them. And then just the journey of, this is how we fixed it. This is the result that we're getting now that we fixed it. And so this is why a lot of people incorporate whiteboards. It's just a communication tool to say, here's some, you know, and it's also a tool for people to write down, hey, this happened today. This is a problem. Yeah. I mean, I would just say have some real structure around it, have some expectations around it, but the transparency is key. And as long as they know we're going to prioritize these, you know, we have to. And I also think that helps them get better at selecting projects or ideas.
The more you have to choose from, hopefully, you know, you're getting more at-bats, you might say, of like evaluating an idea. Mm-hmm. I like what you said earlier. I want to connect that back to, it's an important job of the leader to explain why. Because, you know, if you are going to say no to someone's idea, it probably helps to explain why you're saying no to it.
Right. Yeah.
Have you ever had a situation of, let's say you go into a new shop and, or, you know, you're at the Gemba, you're on the floor and talking to value add associate, and you're like, yeah, we're talking about continuous improvement. And they're just like, yeah, good luck with that. I tried to share an idea once and I got shut down. I'll never do that again.
Yep.
What would you say to somebody like that who might, you know?
I would always ask, tell me what happened. Tell me what the situation was and what were you trying to fix? And, you know, what is your system right now for letting people know? I would just kind of dig in. You know, you mentioned it earlier that a previous guest talked about being curious. That is 100% the key to this job. You have got to be curious and you've got to listen. And just that curiosity of saying, tell me why, tell me what happened. Who did you go talk to? What was the response that you got? And then I would just take all that information and say, that would be really good. How would you like to see this work? Knowing that we can't solve all the problems, what do you think would be a fair way to kind of collect ideas? So you just get that. You're sort of setting that expectation. You're managing that expectation, right? You're kind of politely giving it back to them, like, we can't solve them all, but what do you think we could do, should do? And then I would connect with that leader after and say, hey, here's some feedback I got from your team. What could we do about this? They're feeling this way. Do you feel like this is an accurate representation? How are we going to give them what they're looking for and solve the problems that you want to solve too? So I think I would just connect those dots.
So you've shared so many good insights and little thoughts. I love this. This has been so good. So here's one that I had prepared just as a question. So if a leader wanted to start improving the culture tomorrow, what's a small but powerful step they could take?
I mean, the first thing I would do is I would just talk to people. You have to let everybody know, hey, everybody, look at this, is going to be the direction for us because this is why we think this is important. And then have it stair-stepped. And so I think a plan first, so that people can see there's an actual strategy around it the first time you're bringing it up to your people. Yeah, I don't know. As I say that, I'm kind of wondering if maybe I would just go out and start talking to people first and collect some ideas and then go back and say, hey, we had some really good ideas. Here's how we can start to work towards a better culture of improving. Maybe I would do that, Keith. I'm going to backpedal on myself. I think I will go talk to them first and just listen and then come up with a strategy to say, here's how we're going to start to build this culture. But it is a culture of listening and acting. So acting on the opportunity.
The curiosity, the asking, I think that's such a good lesson there and insight on what it means to have an improvement culture. I'm kind of curious, because you've seen some organizations go through different phases and cycles, and again, you don't need to point out whether it's a current company or a prior company. Are there things that you've seen organizations or even leaders do that undermine the continuous improvement culture? Maybe mistakes that were made. And again, you don't have to throw anybody under the bus, but what are some things that people should watch out for in building that culture in their organizations?
Yeah, I think there are some real common trends for sure. And I think there's some good intention behind them, but assigning it to a few. You know, here you are the continuous improvement leader. You are a continuous improvement champion, and go off and make it happen. So you just assign it to a few people. It's not really a culture, and it's not supported at multiple levels. Those people will fail, and they are going to be very frustrated because they've been given a task or a stretch assignment in most cases outside of what they do, and they can't succeed in this current way. So
does that look like just assigning like improvement projects to like some companies have like this project management office where it's like this small group of people who just go do stuff. And that probably works for certain strategic initiatives, but continuous improvement, you're saying it shouldn't just be a few people's job. It needs to be something that's at like the core value level and at operating levels, not just the special forces.
I always tell people, I say it this way, which is continuous improvement is a mindset. Process improvement is a methodology. So continuous improvement is about how you think and how you approach your work. And yeah, so I think of them as very different. Project management is about, we have the, you know, this is rigor, right? We have this project that we need to manage, make sure it comes in on budget, comes in on time, and produces the results that we expect. Continuous improvement is empowerment, and it is, hey, this is in my way. This is slowing me down. This is preventing me from getting better. I'm going to take a look at this and figure out how we can do this better at every level of employee. So to me, that's the difference. And so, yes. So from a continuous improvement standpoint, if you were to just give it to a couple people and say, go continuously improve, it just can't happen in a vacuum like that. And so there will be frustration and there won't be any kind of gains, really. I haven't seen that happen.
Sense.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, that's great. So let's talk for just a minute about this topic of AI. Everybody's talking about AI. Everybody's worried about AI taking the jobs and whatnot. I'm curious if you have some thoughts on, you know, obviously AI is great, represents great potential process improvements. What's your take on how AI is impacting this process improvement discipline right now?
I mean, it's definitely here. It's here to stay. It's going to keep growing. But I think it's probably going to have more of an impact in the manufacturing world, right? Automation, robotics. But then there's this whole other world of all these other companies and industries that are using continuous improvement as a retention tool, a development tool, an engagement tool, how to break down silos, how to solve problems with collective thinking, systems thinking. I don't know if you can replace that. This could just be because of where I'm coming from. But to me, it's very much people-centric at this level. So when you look at all the other industries that have adopted it outside of manufacturing, healthcare, I mean, automotive, right? Lumber and buildings, distribution. I mean, just everywhere where people feel like we want to grow, we want to get better. I don't know. I don't know how much you could automate that. I think I'm not thinking that far ahead yet, but I do think it's very much, you can't substitute the engagement tool that it is, the retention tool. I think when employees are engaged, they stay.
Yeah, I think it's certainly an interesting topic. There's a lot of great ways that AI is being used to complement and improve all kinds of jobs. I think that the nature of process improvement work, even implementing AI, even in like super high tech companies, one of the big challenges that I've seen has a lot to do with this idea of how do you facilitate process improvement and changes? Because developers and AI companies and websites, you know, there's no shortage of like ideas of things that they could do. But I kind of equate that with a company that has all of these like ideas bottled up in employees' heads. One of the biggest forms of waste, I believe, that exists in the world in work is this underutilized talent in the form of the brain power of people. So AI is just more of that.
Yes.
So figuring out how to get those ideas of what's possible and actually get that change done. Mm-hmm. And my belief is that it's good job security for process improvement professionals because AI is just filling the idea funnel with billions and trillions of things that could be done.
Yep.
But exactly. There's always people inside organizations that kind of, you know, that has to, you know, go through that. And the lessons of process improvement work and how to work through change with people are definitely important as well.
Yeah, it's true. And by the way, I have to acknowledge the fact that you touched on one of the eight wastes, which is talent, ignoring people development and people talent. That is one of the eight wastes. And so, I mean, you hit on that, right? So again, if you have turnover, that's costing your business.
Absolutely.
All that turnover is costing your business. So this is a known retention tool. So I don't know if you can replace that. But I do want to also just very quickly touch on, Keith, when we talk about companies and the mistakes maybe they make in the continuous improvement world, because this is a very, very common one and takes a real strategy. And that's the control, the sustainment of any improvement, right? So it takes, they're saying it takes 12 to 18 months for a new way to become the old way, for people to be comfortable with it, for it to become that muscle memory where the people do without thinking about it. That's 12 to 18 months of leadership, supporting it, coaching through it, you know, just ensuring it stays, getting feedback, pivoting when they need to pivot. Oh, you know, this maybe didn't give us the result that we were looking for. Let's pivot quickly. So, you know, so that control and that sustainment is where I see a lot of failure. And that's where you'll get a lot of fatigue too. We tried that. When you hear somebody say, we tried that, it didn't work, it just was not sustained.
Are there things that are countermeasures to that drop off in sustainment? Like, you know, you do this improvement, you do this project. Are there any things that come to mind that you could share as tips or tricks for how to ensure sustainment is happening on those improvements?
Yeah, there's, you know, there's this a formal control plan for sure, which would include somebody raising the flag, right? Hey, this is off. This isn't working. Somebody, a manager going and spot checking on the new process. Hey, you know what? We are now doing it this way. I just noticed that you kind of went back and did it the old way. Just wanted to check in with you. You know, is there anything in your way of why you wouldn't do it the new way? Those conversations. And then the measurement. Presumably, you measured your current state before you ever implemented a change. Your control should be measured the exact same way. So you have that apples to apples. That measurement's going to be key. And I will tell you, I ran a project where we had such great impact with this project. Every month it was me, you know, pulling like, hey, do you have the numbers? Do you have the numbers? And so it was so important. It was so important to that sometimes, you know, it's going to take somebody having to be, you know, it's a lot of work up front. So we've implemented this change. It's going to be a heavy lift in the beginning because people are going to want to go back to what they know. But if you work this control plan and you measure, you know, consistently, measuring is going to tell you right off the bat when you're off track very quickly. So I mean, those are just some simple ways, but still it's a common issue.
It sounds like having some form of an audit of some kind to check work for a period of time and using KPIs, of course. I love KPIs are part of our name here at KPI yeah. Fireside. So having metrics and using those metrics to tell you, like, are we getting better? Did we get better? What are we trying to improve is obviously near and dear to our heart.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's exactly. Some good advice. Some very good advice. I'd like to move into this little segment I call the rapid fire, which is just a few kind of quick questions and, you know, one word, one phrase, one sentence type answers. So,
okay. I'll do my best, Keith.
You'll do great, I'm sure. So the most important job of a leader is to blank.
Develop their people. That's not one word, but.
No, one word, one phrase, short answer. That's great. That definitely qualifies. Is there a book or a resource that you would recommend? Maybe something that people should read or listen to or anything?
I have it right near me. I'm going to tell you the one that I always recommend people. It's not sexy in any way, Keith, but it's such an important thing. It's the pocket toolbook, yeah. Lean Six Sigma. This has every tool in here for anybody that's going to influence or facilitate or lead an exercise. And I just think it's such a great little handbook, you know?
I love it.
I tell people all the time. I give it to people. Yeah, so.
I love it. I don't have that one, but that's going to be on my Amazon order list here shortly. I love
great.
It. So since you just referenced that, the toolkit there, do you have a favorite go-to problem-solving tool that you, I don't know, maybe you smile a little bit each time you get to pull it out and use it, and share it with somebody for the first time?
Oh, that's great. You know, I will tell you one that I love. It's super simple, but I just love a good affinity diagram. I love a good affinity diagram because you're getting everybody thinking and brainstorming, and then you're organizing their thoughts. But what I love about it is if you didn't have some sort of structure around a brainstorming activity, I think it goes off the rails at times, right? So
describe, kind of explain with words what an affinity diagram might look like for somebody who's trying to picture one.
Sure. Okay. So let's say we are diving into a problem and we want to understand what's happening, what's wrong. So we've got the team in the room and we say, oh, let's categorize it. Is this an issue with resources? Is this an issue with people? Is this an issue with training? Is this an issue with fleet systems, right? So you have these categories and it's just sticky notes. I mean, when I tell you, like, you do not need to get fancy here. But so you've got these categories and you say, okay, start telling me what's wrong with our systems. You know, you got all the stickies of everybody's ideas. The general rule is we do not debate any ideas yet. Let's get them all up on the board. 15 minutes should do it. You can even do it quietly. Everybody has their own pile of stickies. You write down everything you can think of, go up on the board and slap it under the column that it goes under, and then we'll talk about it. And so the affinity part of it is really you start to now see items that were repeated by people. So this helps you prioritize. Hey, we think this is a real big problem because 6 people mentioned it, you know? And then the last piece of it is the team votes. So we can't work on everything. You know, what do we think are going to be some of the most critical things to work on? Everybody goes up and stars their top 5 or whatever. And so then the team votes. And so this whole exercise is really simple. It gets people up and moving around, but it helps them organize their thoughts. It helps you as a team prioritize your thoughts. And then the team has a say in saying, this is what we want to go work on.
And part of making everybody feel involved. I like that. That's a great way to use that that tool. That's excellent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Finish this sentence. Continuous improvement is
a mindset. I know I already said it, but
I love it. That's great. This is kind of a philosophical question. Is it more important to feel successful or be successful?
Ooh, Keith, boy, I don't know, because I mean, you know what? I don't want to say, my gut would say to be successful, but if somebody feels successful and that brings them in every day and that means they're a contributing member, maybe they're part of your 80%, they're not your top 10, but it brings them in every day and they're contributing. I don't know. That's value too. But I guess my instinct would say be successful. I don't know. I don't love that answer though.
I love that question because I don't know the right answer either.
Yeah,
it's one I think a lot about.
Yeah, exactly.
Like you said, like if you feel successful, you're more likely to continue to be engaged. You could be successful but not feel it and probably stop doing what you were doing to be successful. So I don't know. It's a fun conversation.
It is fun. Yeah.
Okay. My last question is, what are you most fired up or excited about going forward?
I just love being part of the big picture. So that to me, you know, and I started Safe Flight about 1.5 years ago. So I will be hitting my 2-year in a few months. And so I feel like all the introductions are behind me. I've worked with everybody now for a while. We really, like, I'm part of the company is how it feels, you know? And so I'm excited now to be in there and just moving forward, being a part of that big picture. I've always loved that. I've always loved like the big picture thinking and how can we incorporate what we do into what the company is trying to do.
I love that. That's a fantastic answer. I think it resonates well with I think I have a belief that people would prefer to work somewhere where they feel engaged, they feel like they're making an impact versus something that they're not. I love that this thing we call continuous improvement, this discipline, is a good recipe basically that you can follow, you know, show respect, be curious, all of the tool set that goes along with it. But so much of it has everything to do with people and processes and getting at that heart of that feel successful or be successful question.
Yes.
I find it just infinitely interesting. So, well, Christine, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast here today. It's been really fun to have a conversation with you and just dive in deep to all of this stuff, continuous improvement. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Keith. This was so fun. I enjoyed this. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
You bet. You bet. That concludes this episode of KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. If you have enjoyed today's episode, be sure to follow us on the socials, share it with a friend, add a comment down there on YouTube or on the podcast player, maybe a rating. We would love that. And share it with people who are as passionate about continuous improvement as you are. You can find us wherever you get your podcast. And until next time, keep driving progress and sparking change.